yesterday we took up the issue of the proper way that a person has to relate to his responsibilities in terms of his own personal responsibility. What is the realm of human responsibility in this world, and what is the realm in which a person expresses his dependence on God, so to speak, or his faith in God? We should try to deal with that issue. Unfortunately, it seems right now as though the tape is missing, but hopefully we'll try and retrieve some of these ideas. And we were making the point, specifically I was analyzing the case of Yaakov, and on the surface it seems to be ambivalent. It doesn't seem to be the image of what the normal person would regard as the religious man, nor does he seem to be the image of what the average person would regard as the practical man, pragmatic man, because he's operating in both arenas. He takes all the measures that are necessary. He prepares for war, he prepares for going, and then he gets involved in prayer. So he seems to be involved in two completely different areas. So what is the underlying principle? So I wanted to say that this is the idea of that God, it's not exactly, it doesn't mean that God helps those who help themselves, because it depends upon what exactly they're trying to really do by helping themselves. How are they helping? Help themselves to do what?
Really helping them.
Yeah. But if they're truly helping themselves, from an objective, in other words, a person is acting in a way that you would regard as selfish. I explained that there's nothing wrong with selfishness. In fact, the person's obligated to be selfish, if you define selfish properly. And as I mentioned, I said, it's impossible. By human nature, it's impossible to do something which is, from the psychological standpoint, which is selfish. Man cannot act in a selfish way. But he can, from a philosophical standpoint, he can act in a self-destructive way. Because I define selfish as doing that which is beneficial to the self. But what is the self? The true self. Meaning in terms of man's true nature, true identity. So everything a person does requires a motivation. And that motivation is something within the self. Even if he's doing the favor for somebody else, you have to ask yourself, why is he doing it? So there's got to be a motivation. He wouldn't do it if there was no motivation. Either it's because he wants to make the other person happy, he derives some satisfaction from that, or he hopes to get something in return, or else he can't tolerate the pain that it will cause him if he doesn't do it. He feels guilty if the other person doesn't like him anymore. So whatever it is, he's doing it to alleviate an emotion within himself. So that's, to me, that type of so-called selflessness is really selfish. In the case of Yaakov, he said that it wasn't two unrelated activities. Everything he was doing was service of God. It was a different concept of service of God. The fact that he accepts the challenges that life places before him and doesn't withhold himself from them. And each person, that is a concept of Nisayon, of a test. And we see that, well, I also made the point that the Torah depicts almost all of the great individuals in the Torah. The way the Torah depicts them is very strange. It's not the contemporary method of depicting the Dolem, like the Archdol mentality. You know, where you get a few eccentric people, otherworldly types of people who are constantly involved in praying and running and then so on and so forth. You don't see that at all in the Torah. You don't really get a view of Avraham Avinu sitting around thinking or studying or learning or even doing mitzvot. The Torah usually presents them confronting the challenges that life has placed before them. And therein lies their greatness, in that they do not walk away from the responsibilities of reality. And that itself is an essential component of their perfection. Because it means that they did not understand the relationship to God as being something which is based upon the childish model. The childish model is where a person seeks to escape from the responsibility. He turns to God to help him escape. You see? And That's why that's a false relationship to God. A person has to relate to God in the framework of God's will for him, in the framework of reality. And first and foremost, it means that he has to assume responsibility for his so-called bundle. Each person is given a certain type of a bundle. The amount of freedom that we have is limited. I mean, many, many things are sort of predetermined. And each person, it's God's will that each person should live within a certain context, which is determined for him, his own ability, first of all, his physical constitution, his looks, his ability, his family, his society, his context. I mean, there's a certain amount of freedom a person has to make changes, but so much of it, the challenges that he's going to face in life are sort of set for him. And that's the idea of self-control. The person has to accept that that's the will of God. Of course, it doesn't mean to be totally passive, that a person does have the power to make changes. So there's a fine balance, of course. This should not be. I'm not advocating a policy of resignation, where a person sits back and just resigns himself for whatever happens without doing anything about it. But of course, a person has to know the boundary line, those things that are within his power to change, and those things which he has to accept. He has to deal with reality. Will place before him certain challenges. And it's the way he responds to those challenges, which is a significant element in his perfection, as I was mentioning yesterday with regard to Avraham. And you see, by the way, that a person can be a tzaddik kol yamav. A person can be righteous all his life, and then suddenly a situation can occur, and that situation creates a responsibility for him, and his failure to respond properly can seriously affect his standing. You see what I'm saying? That really wouldn't happen with a different type of a view of a perfected person. He says in the Sabbath, and he has the right emotions and the right... So basically how he responds to different challenges would not be incorporated in terms of his perfection. And you see in the case of Avraham. When by Yevel HaPolis, that's the whole story over there. That his nephew Lot was captured in that war, the four nations against the five nations and so forth, and the poet, because also that was Ognon HaBasan, and he had a very selfish motive. He came to Avraham to tell him. So now Avraham was confronted with a challenge. And how he responded to that challenge was a significant factor in his perfection. But he accepted it. You see, that's the idea of Nisayon. Well, God actually confronted him with Nisayonis, but specifically but everybody, I think, is confronted with Nisayonis. Situations arise. You can't just ignore them, because the failure to get involved in them itself is a sign that you're not fulfilling your responsibility. By the way, we were just talking about what we've been doing in the Gemara. Because, see, in Yadus, a posture of passivity is also considered to be evil in certain situations. That's a very important point. It's not just, Yadus is not just a system which demands, action and then rates you, judges you, on how you perform in certain situations. If you're like, one is active in business, so you do your business honestly, ethically, etc., etc. But what about passivity? If a situation arises which demands that you step in, well, Talon El Dan Re'echa. A person who fails, and the Rambam says that a person, by doing nothing, could be responsible for the worst evil. It's like the Va'abe Kol Olam Kulo. So therefore, your fate can be determined by circumstances which is purely outside of yourself. In other words, what do I need this for? I mean, you didn't do anything wrong. The person goes into business and he's trying to make money, and then he cuts the corner, he doesn't act ethically. So he accepts the fact that, we all accept the fact that, you did something. You shouldn't have done this. You should have been honest. I mean, no one's going to argue with that. If you didn't want to be honest, then you shouldn't have gone into business. Don't go into business and don't, and you won't have a problem. Won't have any extra problems. See, there a person has the option to do that. and to say, okay, I didn't go into business because I realized that business entails too many problems, too many gray areas, and I prefer to be safe. So I won't go into business, so I won't be wealthy. But a person could be in a situation and circumstances purely outside of his control confront him with a real challenge, a challenge to his perfection. And that is the case where a Jew is in danger. Especially driving home at night, you know, going to shul, whatever it is learning all the time, driving home at night, minding his own business. He just wants to go home. He doesn't want to bother anybody. He never would bother anybody. And suddenly a situation develops, and he realizes that people are in trouble. There's burglars in there trying to break into their house. And there's a tremendous temptation to just keep going. Because he's not even that blatant, not 100%, you know. And here is a different type of a challenge. Because it's easier for a person to say, I didn't want to. I didn't do anything. What am I doing? I'm just going home. You see? Now that is a different type of a thing where a situation outside of himself has presented him with a challenge. And his failure to respond would be a serious imperfection. A person can't just exempt himself from that. He can't just exempt so evil is not merely the fact that you're acting in an evil way. It's the fact that you fail to accept the challenges that your own particular set of circumstances has placed you in. God willed if you act in this situation, you accept the responsibility. And if you fail to accept the responsibility, then it's a serious imperfection. Even though he hasn't really done anything. And even though he wasn't involved, I mean, he had nothing to do with the situation. But the failure to respond is a serious defect in the person. By default. The person can really become corrupt in Yahadus by default, by just doing nothing. And that could be the worst evil. An amazing kind of thing. In Yahadus, part of the perfection of the individual is the fact that he accepts his responsibility in terms of the circumstances, the physical context in which he finds himself. You see, and he doesn't just throw up his hands in despair and turn to God to save him from the situation, to save him from the challenge. There's a very subtle point. There's a difference. Like Yaakov was confronted with the challenge of his brother. So when he turned to God, it wasn't like throwing up his hands in despair, like God saves me from this situation. You see, what am I praying for? Am I praying to be saved from the situation, from the need to deal with the situation? No, because Adelphi accepts the fact. And I wanted to say that's a form of Kabbalah or Malchatamayim. It's in the prophet. Think about it. It's in the prophet. The Yahavu Hashem Alkecha B'chol Levavcha B'chol Nafcha B'chol Ma'odecha. You should love God with all of your soul. The Chazal say, "Achal Pishum Notelos Nafshecha." That a person's Ahavat Hashem has to be expressed. You see, in the framework of the context of reality that God has decided for him. So Yaakov didn't complain to God. Why do I have this situation? Why couldn't you work it out so that Esav was gone somewhere else? See, it never occurred to him to think along those lines. That, by the way, that's also the case. That's what the Elohim represents. You see that Rashi always says by Abraham that as soon as Abraham left his homeland and he came to Canaan, then immediately by there was a famine in the land. So Rashi says that was a test for Abraham to see whether Abraham would be Mahar or Acham Idosa, whether he would wonder about God's ways. You see? Because that's the natural. That is a natural response, impulse of a religious individual. Why he's not satisfied with the situation? Why is it happening this way? But Abraham didn't look at it that way. He simply adapted himself to whatever situation God placed before him. That itself is a service of God. That's the point that I wanted to make. That from that context, every challenge that a person is confronted with is an opportunity for the service. The way he responds to that challenge is itself a service of God. He's perfecting himself. He's freeing himself from a false religious impulse, you know, a childish idea that God saves him from reality. And he's cleansing himself. And therefore that is the way you respond to the situation. That itself is a form of perfection. And it's in line, I think, with the Rambam's idea that there's more to live, that whatever the Rambam says, that a person serves God, the perfected individual serves God in all of his actions, even when he's eating, even when he's sleeping, even when he's doing business. Every area of life is a service of God. If a person is motivated, if he has the proper motivation, he's doing it in the proper context. You see? So that itself becomes a service of God. So I will go to that Rambam a little bit later. He brings it down in Deos. In all of your ways, you should know God. Everything is an expression of the desire to get closer to God. Okay? But it has to be done. It has to be done in the context of a person who realizes that it's God's will that we, you know, we live in this context, in this situation, and it imposes responsibilities upon us, and we don't turn to God because we desire that God should save us from our responsibility. That doesn't exist. And nobody in the Torah, you see, the greatest people that are presented to us are people who had tough lives. It doesn't mean that it seems to be quite the contrary. Right? The greater the person, the tougher the situation that they face. Look at the lives of Yaakov, David, Yosef. I mean, everybody, no one, you don't find any support for that idea that somebody was exempted from challenges and problems because of his service of God. Okay, in other words, the view of we discussed this many times, the view of the Rambam, it seems to be most of the Rishon, with regard to Hashkafa, God's providence, pertaining to the individual, is that there is such a thing that certain events occur to a person because it's the direct will of God. For example, a classical case where, you know, a person had reservations to go to the airplane and certain things occurred, he was delayed, there was a traffic jam and so on and so forth, he got there and missed the plane, he was upset, and then that plane crashed. In retrospect, you know, the average individual has this tremendous surge euphoric feeling that God really saved him. But then the question we have to ask is it true that, you know, I mean, these things happen to you naturally too? You know, just to assume that all the things that happen, the traffic jam, so on and so forth, that all the things are being removed just to save you could also be a very dangerous narcissistic view. And isn't that overestimation of yourself? Maybe it's just chance. So the view of the artist is that you really don't know. It could be the result of chance.
And you know, no way.
Most religious people believe that everything that happens is the direct will of God, specifically. Most religious people, the fact that most religious people believe it doesn't mean that it's true. It's a very serious issue. The Rambam takes it up in the Mor, and he goes to the various positions on Hashkafa. Rambam's position is a little bit ambiguous, or leaves a person in a state of ambivalence, because he says that it could be the direct result of God's will, but it does not have to be. Because if you find, for example, let's say you find a primitive tribe somewhere, and all of them are living basically like animals, and then and none of them have any connection whatsoever to God in any objective kind of realistic kind of way, alright? And then, you know, there's a hurricane or some kind of an earthquake or whatever. And you'll find in any group that there are, you know, say 75% were killed and a few just because of some accident per se. So what are you going to say? That God wanted just to finish the day? Yeah, the realm doesn't help now. And it doesn't, because what gives you the right to say it? Well, how do you know that these individuals are all under divine providence? Why must it be the case? That's not the case. It means to say that why can't you say that God set up a world? This is providence. The way the world operates according to the system of law. For example, in Birkas HaMazon, where most people have the idea that they're basically thanking God for feeding them. But take a look at Birkas HaMazon. You're not really thanking God. Where's the thanks? You're basically praising God that God sees the whole world, but you're not saying anything to God that's anything specific to you. Who knows him as Lechobosa? To the own Tosso. It's really an impersonal kind of a thing. Because you're not saying in that blessing, thank you for what you did for me. You're simply saying, you know, what you're praising God is that the greatness of God as a creator is that he set up a world in which everything has confined what it needs. So the world is functioning properly. That's the greatness of the creator. But those very same laws, it's a world that operates in accordance with laws, and those laws will produce certain results. And those results will not always be beneficial to every individual. What's wrong with that? Now, that, of course, the question is, does God, who is the creator, simply place man in an environment in which he can function, and he gives him the proper tools, he gives him the divine in him, the telemolist in him, he basically provides him, that's what God's not saying, he provides us with all that we need. And we're grateful to you for that. But imagine that a person wants to help people. So he builds. He goes into the ghettos and he builds this beautiful new city, this new installations and schools and so forth and teachers and everything. And he has now created an opportunity for people to really gain and benefit. The system is set up intelligently with all kinds of proper guidelines and so on and so forth. Does that mean, so he really cares about this group, does that mean that every particular event that's happening to every particular individual is now under, he steps in and, no, he needs to go. Well, maybe
not a perfect analogy.
No, it's certainly not perfect. I'm just trying to show you that there'd be nothing wrong with that idea that God has created, obviously, anything that a human being constructs cannot in any way, you know, be compared to what God does. Now, whether or not a person comes under the direct divine providence depends upon his level of closeness to God. That is the premise. A person who has no relationship to God, so he's basically living in the world of the physical, and therefore whatever happens to him is basically determined by the physical. So there, according to the Rambam makes clear, according to his position, that there is such a thing as chance. Not everything that happens to every individual at every time, it's God's will that it should happen to them. There's laws of nature. If a person goes on a trip and he doesn't bother to get the proper equipment, and there's a storm and his boat capsizes, it doesn't mean that it was God's will that he should die in the sea. All these things can be explained. That's the position of the... Now, with regard to this issue, is this the thing of simply being at the wrong place at the wrong time? There, yes. Chazal say when the given out the sword to destroy Einu Machin Bein Tov L'Ra, it doesn't distinguish between the good and the bad. That means it's not against you. That's what Chazal is saying. We talk about people that perish in the Holocaust. You're going to find yourself in a very difficult position. Because you're going to have to explain how many righteous people were killed. Why weren't they saved? And how come many wicked people were saved? You always find a situation like that.
It's an explanation for it.
Yeah, there's an explanation. It's fine.
No, fine.
But Chazal give an explanation. They say that the sword doesn't distinguish between the good and the bad. So that's the will of God. That too is the will of God, that there should be a sword, and that once that sword is unleashed, it doesn't distinguish between good and bad.
But
that's the way the world works. Why? What's wrong? Now, that may be unpleasant to the individual, but if that's the will of God, so what's wrong with it? If it's God's will that you should function according to the laws of nature. Now, again, I'm not ruling out providence. It can be specifically that it was God's will that saved this particular individual from that plane. It could be, but it doesn't have to be. And I don't see why the other view to me has a lot of difficulty. Why is it that all these people perish? Could have been a plane load of righteous individuals, and the person that was saved was a mafioso, didn't deserve anything. And you have a real problem. This person would have been killed. What if you're going to maintain that everything that happens is because God directly intervened? If God directly intervened, so what? Why would the other people say? He'll say, you don't know, but I don't know what you mean by saying that anyway. Because you're going to wind up saying, I don't know. And you're going to wind up embracing an idea which at bottom doesn't make any sense to you. I don't see that it alleviates any type of a problem. To say that it's simply that it has a meaning. Why don't we simply say that God created the world and that's His will? Olam Shemin Hagar Noe, it's His will that the world should function according to His rules. I mentioned the Rambam as an authority, and the question is, how can anyone be so presumptuous as to claim to have any understanding of the ways of God?
Yeah,
but listen carefully and don't take it the wrong way. You are guilty of that very same thing yourself. By you saying that it has to be, and so firmly convinced that it can't be otherwise, that everything that happens must be the will of God, weren't you being very presumptuous and saying, I know how God works, and God can't work any other way? You've raised a very, very, very good point, unbelievably good point, indirectly. The point being, though, what about the issue of presumptuousness? We're talking about things, really, that we don't have any knowledge. We're lacking in knowledge. So how do we talk about things like this? How about even if we quote the Rambam? The Rambam is a human being.
Yeah.
So the point, it's a very good point, and I would tell you that if there were no such thing as a divine revelation and questions such as this, then we would all be extremely humble. Well, we could speculate how it might be. Intellectually it's something we could discuss, but we'd all have to realize that here's a perfect situation for pluralism. The issue of pluralism, then you'd have to be very liberal. You can't have the issue framed this way, in favor of pluralism or against it. It all depends on what situation. In a situation of ignorance, where there's no way of knowing an absolute truth, so then it's beneficial to give each person an opportunity to express at least an intelligent view, which you can learn from. Now, over here, the Rambam is not setting forth his own theories, his own ideas. It's not a realm of theories, because how can anyone be so audacious as to say this is how God works?
Yeah.
That's why the Rambam is not saying it from the perspective of his own personal knowledge. It's based upon his study of the Torah. The only reason why we have a right to speak of these issues about God is because of the Torah, because God has revealed information to us, and even that is limited, and even that is not 100%, hasn't been presented to us in a straightforward manner, and requires tremendous analysis. You have to be on a level of an individual who can even interpret the data properly. So the Rambam, now this is the kind of a thing, which is the kind of an area where it seems that the majority of the authorities and scholars basing themselves on the Torah, the statements in the Tanakh and Chazal have come to the and also because of their understanding of certain principles of how God relates to the world, have come to the conclusion that the Rambam enunciates. It seems Ramban seems to hold the same view. Most of the Rishonim that I am aware of have come to this conclusion that Einei Adoshem El Yireya, that the eyes of God, now the eyes of God always refer to divine providence, specific providence, are upon them that fear Him. You see? So the relationship, a personal relationship between God and man, it depends upon the level to which the individual is able to raise himself to an intellectual relationship, to partake of the world of ideas which is more closely related to God. And when he enters into a certain realm, then it's a natural thing. As he gets closer and closer, he becomes more and more under God's providence. It doesn't mean to say that if he's not on such a level, you have to understand. It doesn't mean to say that if a person's not on that level, that he's a bad person and God doesn't care about him, or that he has no share in the world to come. We're talking about different issues over here. A person can be a righteous individual. That's why it says the sword may not distinguish between the good and the bad. That good person is a good person. He's a righteous individual. He may have a share in the world to come. But to merit that type of intervention, where he will be freed from the harmful effects of untoward events, that's a different system. That's being part of a different system. He may not be on that level. And that's another thing he has to accept. That's part of the Sabozo Long Shemayim. That he's not on that level, and it may not even be his fault, because he may not have the ability to be on such a level. That's part of acceptance. Acceptance means that's part of the Tachmon. That you can't envy someone else. I accept my limitations. I accept the fact that I'm not a God. I accept the fact that I'm not a prophet. I accept the fact that I'm not a person to get on the level of God's Hashkacha. You see, there's a removal of envy from all of these areas. If that's God's will, that I should exist as a person who cannot hope to get beyond being subject to the laws of nature, so I accept that too, and I'm happy with that. He has to accept and be familiar with the sailor. Perfection is not measured by attaining a certain amount of knowledge. I think that's a mistake that people have. That's a mistake that people have because everybody's trying to be the Gadol HaDor, to know as much as the Rav knows, to know as much as Rav Moshe knows.
We should be gluttons in our attempts to...
Yeah, that's true. It's not measured, I don't think it's measured by that. It's measured by the... Since each person is different, it's measured... It has to have a subjective element. This is the day that you're in the most reflective state that you should be in. Of course, there's certain general things. And one of the general things is that you raise yourself to the level of knowledge. You raise yourself to a proper concept of God, insofar as you can have it, and to a proper relationship. All these components are the components of perfection. Those are universal, but to say who is more perfected, it's impossible for anybody to say, because it all depends upon the level of the individual. Okay? The level of the individual. So, all of the Gedolim have made that point. Moshe would say, it could be that individual who's struggling, take some analogy to figure out a couple of lines in the Gemara, could be a more perfected individual. See, because perfection is not measured by how much information you have or how much knowledge you have. It's the state of the soul vis-a-vis the good.
What is that?
Well, effort is like, well, of course, a person that's struggling mightily to get closer to God and has to put up with a great deal of frustration, this indicates a certain perfection of the soul, because it's a love of God, and it's an acceptance, a mature acceptance of the limitations that he has, and he's not just acting on the basis of petty emotion. The person's frustrated, why should I? How come I have to work so hard? That's actually the thing. Yes, we'll call me Alpha. That's the element of perfection. That's why it's hard to measure. You don't know. You don't really know. You don't know what the inner life of another individual. You don't know. So you don't really know. All we can see is externally, basically externally. The Maisa, the Rambam says, that the Shia Chelz Nohar is based upon Rav Chach Masa of a Gadol Masa, I believe. Rav Chach Masa of a Gadol Masa. It means to say that that's the careful, of course. If a person is not basing his relationship to God in terms of Chachma, then he's out of the ballpark altogether. That's what the essence of what's human is, Chachma. To partake of Chachma is what's human. That's the Talmud of him. If he doesn't partake of Chachma, then he's just not in there. He's not fulfilling God's will. That's God's will for him as a Talmud of him. You have to look at the Torah. God created us to be a Talmud of him. But that perfection is not just the acquisition of knowledge. It's acquisition of knowledge is a means to the perfection of the soul.
Right.
You see? So those two are expressed, of course, in his deed.
Right.
And deed is very important, as I said. Right. Deed also includes the way in which you react to the circumstances in which God has placed you. So you can have a phenomenon of Yisrach and Zevulun. That, a partnership where one person is really engaged primarily not in the learning, of course he has to have knowledge, otherwise it can't be an appreciation, but all the work that he's doing is really a service of God, because he's working to support Torah. So he's engaging in the challenges of the physical world in order so that somebody else can do the learning. You see? So that's a service of God, because he's directing all of his energies to furthering the will of God. Now, of course, that person himself, it must be viewed as in a real, genuine appreciation of the Chachma of Hashem. If he doesn't have that, you see, then it's lacking something. And it's lacking because then you have to be very careful. A person who do many good deeds, we've had these discussions a lot. A person who can do many, many good deeds, but for the wrong motivation. So the question is, do they count as good deeds? Well, that's a discussion that's done. We're continuing the discussion from yesterday, and this question knows that whether it is appropriate to quote unquote negotiate with God. Now, before we can proceed, I want Mel to further clarify that question. What do you mean by negotiating with God? I'm just making the point that Aaron Max is bringing up in the name of Aaron Lockwood. The point that Max is bringing over in the name of Aaron Lockwood is that it would be a bad thing for people who are on a lower level, on the spiritual level, to be subject to the Ashgacha of practice. It is, well, that's not what he's saying. I'm sorry, he's wrong there. He's saying that it would be a that it's a good thing for them to be subject to the Ashgacha close, because that is a humbling experience. What do you mean by that? That's a humbling experience. I would say that's definitely true, that being subjected to reality is a humbling experience. And that's why it's good for everybody. That's a Gemara, by the way. The Gemara says that, my take gave me a presentation, that a person reaches his hands into his pocket to figure out, like, I take today to pull out a quarter. And he comes up with a nickel, so that's a kapara. That statement lends itself to a false expectation. It's funny how these statements of Chazal somehow or other seem to make sense to people, but in not in the correct manner. It's just, you know, like if this type of Chazal makes sense to people on the basis of their false ideas, and they attribute to Chazal their false ideas. The way that I say explain that was, that I think the Chazal has always been discussing, is that it affects a person in terms of his relationship with God. It is to say that it's a frustrating experience, and he accepts the frustrations of reality, of Kabbalah HaYishuim. That he accepts upon himself the fact that reality is not structured in a way that caters to his own fantasy. That is the childish, narcissistic, religious imagination that everybody carries with him. And it's precisely that a person has to address himself to, and has to uproot in this person in order to have a real relationship with God. In other words, the real problem is that a person by nature cannot have a true relationship with God. There's something which is standing in the way. It's religion. It means that each person harbors within himself very powerful religious emotions. Well, you can call them what you like. They're really wishful thinking emotions. It's a certain fantasy of how reality ought to be, in which he envisions himself as being the center of reality and that everything really exists for him. It's simply a magnification and a projection of self-love on the universe. And that's the basis. See, when that obviously doesn't work, as a person has to deal with the world of reality, he sees that it's not working. So therefore, he now projects it onto some type of a religious system. He hopes that the religion will provide him with his narcissistic needs. So he's using religion for those purposes. That's why today you have all these different movements. It's all based upon the same thing. It's what makes me feel good. It's what makes me feel comfortable. It's what they're really saying. It's catered to my fantasy. If it caters to my fantasy, that's a good religion. Now, that's what the Chazal are getting at. That when a person, see, that type of a person, the Chazal speak about the idolaters. Right? When they say that when they're angry at their idols, they kick them. They get angry at their, we learned in the Gemara, about idolaters. They're in the Gemara with it. Yeah, that's what it says. Yeah, that's why it says that if they just certain over there, but it's not fickle necessarily. Because maybe they just got angry when they kick them. Because that's their attitude, which means that they view it as being something which is to serve their purposes, to fulfill their needs. So when they don't fulfill their needs, when they're frustrated, they get angry at them. Yeah, but then they go back to the same mentality. Now, in terms of our relationship to God, it has to be based upon reality. And reality, you have to accept your place in the scheme of things. And by nature, that entails a tremendous amount of frustration, because you're always overestimating yourself. But he can't tolerate when he's the butt, and he has to be the kapara, so to speak, and he has to suffer. When things don't work out in accordance with his natural wishes, so he feels angry and frustrated. And that's what it means when a person goes through that experience, even in a minor way. He reaches into his pocket for a quarter, and it's annoying. Because he expects it to be there, and something else is there, and all these, that's a small thing, all the everyday frustrations that we have to put up with. And the fact that he accepts it and he doesn't alter his relationship to God, that's the perfection. That's the kapah. Now, to take the statement that Max said in the name of Aaron Oswald, that I agree that for people who are not on the level of Ashkacha, it is a good thing for them. It's true. I mean, it's a good point. That's not the real reason. We're not saying that the reason why they're subject to the laws of so-called chance, the laws of nature, the Ashkacha Klal, which is not really chance, design, but it means relative to your desire for a particular outcome, it's chance. It's chance. It doesn't mean it works in accordance with laws, but those laws are more or less indifferent to your particular needs in the moment. That's the point. That's what we call a chance. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to conform to what you need at this particular time. But still, it's a good system. So that the reason why we're saying that people on a low level, on an instinctual level, don't partake of the Ashkacha Pratis, the Ramana thing, is because the Ashkacha Pratis is a natural phenomenon. That when a person raises his level beyond the world of the instinctual and becomes involved in the world of knowledge and ideas, he's closer to God, so he's automatically under the particular framework. So therefore, you're not giving a reason, and you don't need a reason. That's reality. You don't have to give a reason. However, it is true, though, that one can see in the design of God, it is part of God's design. That God designed two different frameworks. There's the framework of laws of nature, world of chance, and then there's the framework of the Ashkacha, and it is good that a person who's not on a high level would be bad for him if he were to be the beneficiary of the benefits of the Ashkacha prophet. Because it wouldn't make any sense. Since he's pursuing the wrong goals, it is better that he live in the world of chance. Therefore, he achieves the frustrations, the lessons of life, by the way. That's the greatest learning experience. Learning experience, life itself is a great learning experience. That's what a person learns. What it means, you could study, even without the Torah, a person could study reality. And learn from reality. Reality itself pushes us in a certain direction. It's amazing why people don't learn from their experiences. Any person can learn from experience how overindulgence is dead, how fantasies don't work, how all of their most powerful dreams, all the things that everybody is looking for. You see? Now, you can learn, life itself is the greatest teacher. And why is it the greatest teacher? Because it's been designed by God's purpose. You don't really need a Torah in that sense. I don't mean to say you don't need a Torah. I mean in the sense that a person with intelligence and study reality and come to certain conclusions, he'd be in line with the basic principle direction of the Torah. That doesn't mean he doesn't need a Torah, because the Torah provides us with more information, revelation of how we should move in a positive way. You follow what I'm saying? I just mean to say that at least the removal of the negative, which is a tremendously important part of our education. Removing ourselves from the fault. After all, perfection involves two different endeavors. One is Surah Meiran. And the other is Asay Tov. Now, Asay Tov, you might say, man is laughing, because he really doesn't know what the Tov is. There's a lot of disagreement among the philosophers. What exactly is the Tov? It's very hard to structure the Tov. Even justice is the Tov. Let's say we could agree that justice is good. Yeah, but how do we go about achieving justice? What are the rules of justice? What are the principles? I mean, the human mind is very limited. So you see, when it comes to the Tov, chesed is Tov. Yeah, but what about the other factors? How does chesed work? Chesed is compassion, to help people, to save people. What about Germany? What about a country which had within itself a movement which destroyed millions of people? So how do you look at the country? Should we still practice chesed because those Germans that weren't involved with it? Or to what extent do we say the entire country? I mean, there's a lot of concepts and principles that we really don't know. Human logic really can't decide these issues. And so on and so forth. So the essay tough part of the Torah is something which I think we all recognize, that man can't arrive at this knowledge on his own. But the Simeira part, but the Simeira, in my opinion, I hadn't thought of it this way before, and it ties with with the idea of a monkey, that the simara is something which you don't really need a Torah for that much. Because that's something that life teaches you. The Derech HaShem Tovah, the basic principle of simara, is that the life of the wicked is destined to failure. It doesn't work. We need to possess something that you can study. You can see in reality it just doesn't work. That doesn't require a revelation. And Sumer Rabbah say so. You have to uproot yourself from the fall. You can see that if you study reality, how every path, which is based upon all of these dreams and fantasies, leads to absolute failure and disappointment and disillusionment, or just a total denial of reality. So I think an intelligent person, that's why you do it, by the way. You do have in the world many people that have achieved this understanding, that they can't be part of the system. The only the problem is, that's why you see you need a nice way to tell. They remove their head, they're depressed. They're like cynics, satirists, cynics, whatever, you know, or they're just playing depressed people because they can't get on the program. They can't deny reality. They can't just go on happily believing all these ridiculous fantasies that motivate people. On the other hand, they have nothing else to channel their energy into. So that's why you need the Torah, you know, for the Asei Tov part of it. Okay. Now, with regard to that statement again, I would say two things. First of all, the way God designed the universe, it's designed in such a way that even a person who's not using Chachma, who's just operating basically with his emotions, will have the opportunity to stop in his tracks. That's also incorporated in the idea of close to Gaga, that thorns and thistles. The thorns and thistles represent all the obstacles, the frustrations, the difficulties, that they won't go smoothly anymore. That there is a certain antipathy, so to speak, between man and nature. At one time, and Gan Eden means a situation of almost perfect harmony between man and nature. That's why even in Gan Eden there was a Avodah. The Avda Ulishan. See, the difference in the Navy, he had to do work also, but it was a different kind of a work. I was just thinking about it recently, because it says that God put him in the Gan Eden, La Avda Ulishan, to work it and to keep it. Yet we associate work, there's a Fakat Tokhalak, with punishment. That's what occurred after the, and he was driven out of the Garden of Eden. We're dealing with the idea of work. Now that it's related to the topic, as Rav Moskowitz said, that the thorns and thistles, that's his concept, that it's beneficial to man to experience the frustrations of defeat, because the person is living in accordance with his fantasy. If he was to be successful, so what would ever motivate him to change? That idea is really found in Bereshit. The Kodesh V'Dayah is a Tzion, basically what he's saying. You're going to be forced to stop and reconsider whether this is the correct way to go. Because I'm not... That's really the punishment that goes for the benefit of man. God is saying, I'm setting it up in such a way that you're not going to be able to fulfill your heart's desire. Now, I would say like this, with regard to the Avoda, the Avda of the Shamra, I think it's more of an Avoda of Shmira. It's more of an Avoda of Shmira. It means to say like this, that there's two kinds of work. There's two kinds of work, two kinds of jobs. One is where the system is pretty much still set up. Still set up for you. Yeah, essentially it means that you can't allow it to be neglected. That's Lashamra. The Avda Lashamra. It's an Avoda of Shira. Which means to say that you don't have to worry. We've created the system. We've worked out all the parts. You just have to study how it goes, and if you do the work properly of maintaining it, everything will function smoothly. But if you don't, if you neglect it, then it's going to get all messed up. Now, there's a difference in that type of a work. You can see clearly from the psychological standpoint that once a person studies it, he has a certain assurance. If they're going to a job, there's two kinds of jobs out there. The real stressful jobs are the ones where there's a tremendous amount of anxiety because it's unknown. You make a lot of efforts and you're not sure, you can't guarantee, you really don't have control there's so many factors out there beyond your control, and you gotta track it down, you're working on a project, and you have everything more or less in place, and one factor comes along and the whole thing falls apart and you start from scratch, and then you feel the sense of total defeat and futility. That's the zayas atzecha tocha lechem. I mean, that's the sweat of the brow. It doesn't mean physically the sweat. The physical sweat can be very enjoyable. I guess to have a farm, to have you can enjoy getting out there, getting a work there, come home, and certain kind of work would be satisfying for a person. So when you have a situation where sometimes you get a job like that, that could be a different type of a job where, you know, you just have to manage things. You can set up beautifully, you learn the system, and you don't want to enjoy it. Yeah, stick to the manual and you use your circles, you have the assurance that it's going to work. You have to worry about all these things. This is God saying, I took care of all these things for you. You had a beautiful situation. Beautiful situation, even a beautiful job, because there is a certain satisfaction in getting the job done. And not having, you know, not having that anxiety every day starting out, not knowing, you're not knowing. You know, the market can go on you, this thing can go on you, the others, you know, there's so many factors over here. People that you trust. That's what I'm saying. I was starting to say before that life itself is the greatest teacher. Everything, all the illusions that you start with, including people, how people will operate, that people will be grateful for you, that they'll remember what you did for them, that if you make a minor mistake, they won't go crazy about it. They'll accept your apology and will be able to move on. You know, it's not the greatest test. All of the things, all of the illusions that you begin with, life will disabuse you of them if you study life. And if you make the proper adjustments. Life is a great teacher. In a sense, Shlomo was saying, Lecho Hanomel, okay, I was saying it in a different context. You can learn virtue, in fact, from the creation. That's what it means. It's really saying that. It's a Chazal saying. It's a Torah word given. Then we can learn from the creation. That's a testimony to the infinite wisdom of the Creator, and in His creation is embedded with Chachma, and then it operates in accordance with laws. And therefore, if you study that, you'll see, you'll learn. You'll learn modesty. You'll learn virtue. You'll learn
what
ethics. You'll learn ethics from the creation, from the Bria. It's part of the reality. That's how we explained it at the time. It's all been embedded. That's the way it works. It's part of the reality of things. Yeah, right, exactly. I mean, all these principles that, you know, you don't wait for the last second, you anticipate, you provide, you have a storage, and so forth, what your basic needs are, and all these things are incorporated into nature. Now, after getting back to the idea of work, so that's the difference. After man became involved in the material as an end in itself, then it would be very dangerous to have a universe which is so harmonious and so responsive to his desire. Instead of giving the magnification of his own ego. And his own, his own desire to be the master of the physical world. And that, of course, would deflect him. He'd have no humbleness whatsoever. And he would never pursue the true good. He'd never turn away from his involvement in the physical. So therefore, it had to be a situation of thorns and thistles. And that at least creates the possibility for a person to sit back and reflect, what am I doing myself for? Maybe this is not the arena. Maybe there's something else that's better than this that I should be striving for. That's the question was, so why was there a need for work altogether in the Gan Eden? Getting into a Chumash issue now. We never really addressed that, I don't think. Because he said that before the faith, man was in a state of perfection. In the appropriate state. That is to say that his natural instincts were in line with his purpose, with the chachma. The desire was the chachma. The yetzer was at that point the kor. The yetzer tov was with men. In other words, his very nature was changed. That's how we understand the story of the sin of Adam, that his nature was changed. We've explained it many times. So in that perfect state where he naturally gravitated towards Chachma, so he said that God therefore provided him with all his physical needs. So to have to remove himself from the world of Chachma in order to pursue his physical needs would be bad for him. Wouldn't serve any purpose. So therefore God put him in the Gan Eden. That's exactly what we mean by the Gan Eden. So Max wants to know if that's the case, well, was he supposed to work for a living or wasn't he supposed to work for a living? The money shop, so to speak. So the answer is, Abdul Rishama, it was a different kind of work. A light type of work, as he said. But what was the purpose of that? See, that's part of God's will, that man should not really be distracted from his true vocation. That's why he gave him a light work. So by the very same token, you don't have to give any work anymore. Yeah, it's not that compelling to me that, by definition, man has to work. Yeah, that's true, by the way. That's what we see, but we're not really understanding why. It's just being positive. It could be just confusion with everything, so we have to find the focus one day before. And I could be wrong also, but I think that there is a danger in that type of a situation. Because he had emotions. Due to the fact that he was physical, he had emotions. Right? So basically, he had all the human emotions, the same emotions that he had. Now, the power of the balance of forces, the power of the emotions, that's something else. But he did have the emotions. And that is a very dangerous emotion that everybody has. That emotion of being catered to. The narcissistic. That is what everybody desires. What everybody is pursuing, what everybody is desirous of, is to be beyond the laws of nature. That's why Max is very correct, and that's why everybody's very correct. That's what really is the desire of desires, to free oneself from the laws of reality. Once God placed man in a physical context, he did subject him to the laws of reality. Of course, the terms were different, as man now sin, the terms were different. But these are the laws of reality. And the most powerful emotional desire of man is to be free of the laws of reality. What, you know, there's tremendous fascination to negative and outside with these, like, superheroes. And people forgive us. People forgive them their excesses, if they like them, because they're entitled. They're beyond the ordinary rules. And people will sometimes, they'll criticize them, but they're beyond the rules. They don't expect. You have to look at it this way, and he's a big man. So it means to say that there's a certain sympathy, a certain envy, that everybody would like to be in that situation where they're beyond the rules. And that's also why there's this powerful fantasy that everybody has to win, you know, that lottery. The lottery means I'll be free. That's what it really means for a person. I don't think a lottery means I'll be able to buy this and that. It means I will have made it. I'll be free from the demands of reality. Everybody else has to work. I don't have to work. Now that is a very destructive emotion. And you see that people, there are people that have that situation. They're born into wealth. And that is what idle wealth is. Well, it is one of the most destructive things in the human psyche. Very few people can survive it. Most people that are born into these families, well, they didn't have to earn it. And they were born with that, what's it called, the silver spoon in their mouth, so to speak. They were the most decadent lives. It's a torture, it's a nightmare. They don't enjoy it, and they can't achieve anything. They have no motivation, and they have this feeling of superiority, and everybody hates them. People just want to get close to them for their money. It's quite a torture. Though no person would reject that opportunity in defense. Idle wealth. In a sense, I mean, take this statement for what it's worth. There are certain families where they sort of need to avoid that. I'm no big fan of the Kennedys, obviously. In a certain sense, you do see that the Kennedy children, of course, they weren't raised to the proper, you know, the value of ambition and power, but they did avoid a lot of it, some of the negatives, because it wasn't idle wealth. They were raised with the idea that because they have this privilege, they really have to do something for society. So you see, it didn't motivate them. You know, they didn't really lead a life of idle, you know, luxury, indulgence. Of course, they had many, it did have an effect on them because they did indulge. You have to understand, all this is relative. And I'm not giving a study of the Kennedys right now. I'm not a historical survey. I'm not a historian at the moment. No, but you do see that it wasn't total corruption, because they were raised with the ideal that the privilege creates a responsibility to society. So however it expressed itself, I'm not getting into that, they're political philosophers or whatever, to a certain extent they did try to do good for the world, to help. It did express itself in a certain type of liberalism. a certain type of an idealism that they brought into politics. But I'm not going beyond that because that already would get me into politics. Whether I agree with their policies and approaches, I only use it as an illustration that there was a recognition that to just bring food into the world is a situation of tremendous wealth with no sense of responsibility is basically destroying. So I'm saying, going back now to Adam, even in that most affected state, it would be bad for him, for a psyche, to be in a situation where he was being catered to in a completely narcissistic fashion, where he did not even have to take responsibility for his own subsistence. So that's why the Avda Ulusama, there's no such thing. Being part of this world carries with it responsibilities, and of course those responsibilities were tailor-made to the improved state that Adam was in at the time. In other words, God did not want him to have responsibilities which would be so demanding that it would really seriously intrude upon his ability to be involved in Chachma. So that's why they were perfectly made, perfectly designed. We are Dovah Shamba. That is to say that if he uses his seichel, uses his intelligence, and maintains the proper discipline, then the garden will thrive. Okay? So that is sufficient to remove him from that state of a narcissistic fantasy, where he can get into that emotion. And therefore he'd be spoiled. He'd be spoiled. It wouldn't be good for his psyche. But he has to know that these are the terms of his relationship with God. That the God is not just this imaginary father figure that's just going to treat you like a baby. That living in the world of reality carries with it responsibility. Even in Gan Eden, the Avdu L'Shama, to maintain your own certainly, of course, when the situation got worse, when man deteriorated, so then, changes are made. Changes. Life as you know it. So there is a path back to the Garden of Eden. The gods have placed certain obstacles along the way. And if we could discover what they are, maybe we could remove them. With the blessing of God, and find our way back. To fire in the night, to fire up. And I have to do that when the lot of fire in the cover. But that doesn't show. So just again, we were discussing the idea of Hashkafa, the view of the Ramban, which he states in his Pirush on the Torah, and it's the view of the Ramban, the Sforio mentions the same point, Enei Arashem of Yireah, that the eye of God, and the eye of God over here in reference to God's providence, is unto them that fear him. That is to say, let me see if I can put it in a certain framework. The Rambam in the Moram maintains that God's providence does not extend to individuals in the animal kingdom. Okay? Let me see if I can not just tell you what the position is, but sort of try and explain it a little bit. Except with regard to the species. So that it's God's will that the species of animals survive. But what happens to a particular animal? For example, if a person has a pet, a person has a dog, and the dog is very loyal, and so on and so forth. In fact, this dog has been well trained, and the person has used these stories about this whole time. A person is drowning, and the dog goes through all kinds of, rough situations to save this person. And there are stories to that effect where dogs will swim out into the middle of a river or something and save a person, or climb up mountains and save a person. So people say the dog did a good deed. Which I mean, I think philosophically it's difficult to say, to use such terminology. And this is a good dog. And then the dog could be walking down the street one day and a car can come by and kill it. Now, what would you say? Would you say that it was the will of God that the dog should be killed at this point in time? If providence, as you understand it, extends to this situation, what would you say? You're saying that every time anything happens, even if an ant walks by, the Rambam does bring down that view. If an ant walks by, you step on it, so it was God's will that ant should die. That's a very difficult proposition, because what is the basis for that? Such a view. Why would it matter? What would single out? You see, when you're talking about people, And the idea of God's providence, you know, we can sort of approach it, we can understand it. To a certain extent, we can raise issues. Why did this person have to die at this point in time? What could be the reason for that? One, just because we have good questions doesn't mean we can answer it. Or doesn't mean they don't know the truth. But you're going to have a very tough time if you're going to go there first. And then you're going to go beyond that. Every leaf that falls off a tree. I mean, yeah. God's will, this leaf should fall off a tree at this particular point. That, what is the point of such a view? And as a matter of fact, I think that would be, from my point of view, theologically problematic. Now, why would it be a problem? Can anyone see the other side? I don't know, for some reason people like this idea. I think it gives them the feeling that God is so close to us. Now, I'm not saying that Leonard, I'm not saying that about you. It just seems to me that when people talk about things like that, it's stemming from some type of a desire to bring God so close to the physical world, that God is so in touch. Or, perhaps, it gives people a sense of God's greatness, that God is all-knowing. But the fact that we maintain that God is all-knowing does not necessitate the belief that everything that happens in this world is a direct result of God's will. I think that people have this problem, this mistake, that if you assume that the leaf falls off the tree without, not as a result of God's will for you, you're taking away from God's relationship with the universe and implying there are other factors out there. You are implying that there are other factors out there that are responsible. Okay? That's not a theological problem, as I will explain. I just want to see if I'm on target here. I mean, the universe is a scary kind of place.
I don't know.
Basically, the Rambam describes the mitzvah of love of God, which is the most exalted state that a person can achieve, state of Avos Hashem. And of course the problem is, how does one attain it? There's many difficulties attendant upon that. How does one attain a state of Avos Hashem? But the answer, according to the Rambam, is essentially through appreciating the Chachmas Hashem, the wisdom of God, as it is expressed in the system that God has created, in reality, in the laws of nature. So therefore, our Lord founded on the idea that everything which exists only because of the will of God. And therefore, everything that exists expresses perfection. It's a result of God's wisdom. Therefore, we don't believe in any type of a conflict between religion and science. According to the foundations of our system, such a thing is an impossibility. Because they are religion, when I speak about religion, I don't mean what the world speaks about, but I just use the same word and I just prefer a different word if I could find one. I mean Torah. Torah and religion are two entirely different things. There can't be a conflict between Torah, which is the work of God, and the world of reality, which is the handiwork of God. Two books, the same author. And there's now the same perfection. There cannot be such conflict. It's an impossibility, according to the terms of Yahweh. If you don't accept Yahweh, of course, then you could maintain whatever you want. But I'm just saying, those of us who accept the divine character of Torah, which teaches us that the universe exists only because of the will of God, who created it out of nothing, and therefore there were no impeding factors, there were no other causes, there was no primeval matter which was eternal alongside of God, nothing is eternal, and all of existence comes only because of the existence of God, so nothing else exists except God, and everything which exists because of God's will, who fashioned the universe in accordance with his will. The Alma Divara Chirusei, that's what we say in the Kaddish. So therefore, that world of reality which God has created is the gateway for a relationship to the true God, which is exactly what Abraham discovered, contrary to all other idolaters who sought refuge from the world of causality because they were terrified by it. And therefore, they believe that's the product of some evil type of forces. So there are many, many forces out there in the world beyond the visible, the hidden world, the world which they could not see. And in order to cope with it, religion was just a coping mechanism for man's deeper terrors. And we haven't come that far in, 5,000 years, whatever it takes to be. It's still the same for most people. Maybe it's a little more overtly sophisticated. Now, Avraham discovered that there is no conflict between the world of nature, the world of reality, and the supreme being. And if one studies it, it's based upon chukim, chukei shamayim va'aretz, the laws of heaven and earth. And therefore, Abraham began to proclaim the idea of a new God, konei shamayim va'aretz, because he saw the entire universe as directly related to the supreme being who is behind the scenes, so to speak. And this universe is the greatest manifestation of his glory, which is what King David said, as a Mayan Asatan to the tale. The heavens declare the glory of God. So with, and of course, today this has been confirmed by modern science. In the times of Abraham, there was no science that could confirm it. He discovered this through his own brilliance. But contemporary science, of course, has known this, that the universe is a manifestation of the greatest possible wisdom. Therefore, that wisdom must have a source. And everything, and there's answers. Even though one question leads to another question, but as Rabbi Chait one time pointed out, it's absurdity to be the idea of an atheistic scientist is a complete absurdity. Every scientist is a believer. I said, no, he is a believer, because if you maintain chaos, so what are you studying? Why you find contradictions? In other words, if I'm going into a lunatic asylum where everything is based upon craziness, there's no order, there's no planning, and I see all these different types of structures and arrangements inside, and I'm going to try and find out what the reason is, it's ridiculous. There is no reason. I find, let's say I can explain one thing and then it's contradicted by another thing. I'm not going to look for the solution, because there is no solution, it's chaos. So if there's total chaos, so where's the system? You're assuming, in other words, science assumes a system. A system assumes someone who's responsible for that system. Or some being of ultimate wisdom responsible for the system. So whether you like it consciously or unconsciously, you're caught in a trap. If you deny the system and you deny the author, so why are you reading the book? And when you read the book, why are you totally convinced that it's logical and there's got to be an answer? How could you be a scientist? How could you be a scientist when you deny God? Okay. Now, with regard to that word, chance, is there such a thing as chance?
What is chance? Let's get a definition.
Well, that's exactly what I'm trying to do. I said God didn't say die for the universe.
Right.
See, for him, the existence of God is clear. He's a true believer. Before we speak about chance in human affairs, let's forget about human affairs. Let's talk about the physical world. So, outside of man. So man presents a new issue due to the fact that with man you have a new phenomenon, free will. So man is not functioning purely according to the law of his nature. So that's why, I'm talking about chance in the realm of the laws of nature. The answer is that there is no such thing really as chance. Because I think by chance people mean something which has no cause. When you use the word accident, see, the word accident, there's really no such thing as an accident. No such thing as an accident. It's simply an expression we use when we don't see the chain of causality. But if the universe operates in accordance with laws which have been set up on the 6 days of creation, then everything is operating in accordance with those laws.
Right.
So therefore, there's no such thing as chance. And when you notice a leaf falling off a tree at a certain time, you call it chance, or a branch falls off and hits something, you call it chance only because in your framework it's chance if you don't see the whole picture. If you saw the total picture, if you had all the causes, in other words,
right.
God, from the perspective of God, it's not chance. God knows why it happened at this particular point in time. God knew that it would happen at this particular point in time. Because
right.
God has the knowledge of the Creator.
Right.
So therefore, from the perspective of ultimate reality, there is no such thing as chance. because a chance again implies something which has no rhyme or reason. It has no cause. It's an accident. And as Leonard is pointing out, there are no such thing as accidents. I agree with you. But when I come to that conclusion, you therefore got to eliminate what you call chance. There are no accidents. Therefore, there's no chance. However, that does not mean to say that God willed for this particular leaf to fall off at this particular time in the way that you understand it. It means that God set up a system, and it's God's will that the system should operate, and once that system operates, all these things are going to happen. There's so many factors to take into consideration. There's the seasons, there's the climates, there's thunderstorms, and so on, and so on, and so on. It doesn't mean that there was a specific reason why it fits in. You're going to try and find an answer. What is the bigger reason, the larger reason, why the leaf fell off at this particular time? Is it so I should come along, and I should look at it, and pick it up, and throw it in the garbage can? I mean, in that sense, if you're looking for that type of a purpose, I'm saying it doesn't make sense. We don't assume that it's God's will that it should fall off at a particular time. It's God's will that there should be a universe. And once that universe exists, many things are going to happen.
Well, can God be both personal?
In other words, excuse me, let's assume that I set up a system on my level, on a human level, and working according to the pattern of rationality and so on and so forth. And the system is for traffic control, for roads and so on and so forth. There are certain places that's going to be the barriers, because I want people to slow down. And then as they, you know, they stop. And then as they go, it's going to electronically cause the barrier to go up so they can go through. Now I say, well, that makes perfect sense. And I set up the system, and there's traffic, and there's factors, and so on and so forth. Okay? So at 3:02, the thing went up. Because my will that at this particular time this thing should go up? No. The following is, it's going up in accordance with the general will. But now at this particular time, because there was no specific will for that. You follow what I'm saying? The fact that a leaf falls off a tree at a given time doesn't have to be a result of a specific will of God that fall off at this particular time. It's a result of the fact that God established a system, and once the system is in operation, all these factors are going to come into the picture. So it doesn't mean it was God's will for this particular event. The event is a result of God's will, but as manifested in the establishment of a system. Because there is a difference. There is a huge difference. You're saying the whole difference attitude of, in terms of God's relationship to his world. And then you're forced to try and account for every particular thing. Why did God want this to fall man out? Obviously, that, by the way, the people who maintain that would be actually denying causality. You're saying there's no system of causality over here. That is true. That historically, I suppose, those who were idol worshippers who took such a view, that nothing happens by chance, and everything is the result of someone's will. It's an idolatrous type of a notion. Because you're denying the laws of nature. And now this maintains that you must accept the laws of nature. Kugei Shemayim Va'aretz. The person who denies causality in nature is basically a kofer. And these views tend to do that. I'm not saying they do, because they... But you get yourself into all kinds of problems over here, and yeah, there's the laws of nature. I mean, it's hard to reconcile both. I see the point. It's hard to reconcile both, because if there are laws of nature, so that's the cause. If it's God's will, so then there's no laws of nature. But yeah, just imagine to accept who takes my life, because that is the foundation of relating to God. I mean, you can only relate to God through the world in which you find yourself. And then how you define that world, how you relate to it, is crucial in terms of your relationship to God. Will it be a correct relationship, or will it be an idolatrous one? So that's why we don't believe that everything is happening because of a certain will, for this to happen or that to happen. The will is expressed in terms of setting up the system. That's Shesha Shimei Bereshit. That's what the Torah is introducing us to God's will. Why is the Torah talking about the 6 days of creation? And the seventh day, the whole system was put into effect. Well, what is the point of all that if we're going to deny it? It seems to me that that's the denial of Torah, the denial of reality, denial of God. If you're going to accept, if you're going to accept the creation, you're going to accept the world, then you have to accept the system. That means that everything that functions in accordance with the system. That's a question. That would be a question. Does anything happen over here that's not part of the system? Miracles become the problem if that's the case. See how this is rooted in an acceptance of Chachmas Hashem as expressed in the Teva. That's the whole Tehillim. That's all of the Sukkah Devera. We're talking about the glory of God as it is expressed in His creation, which means everything operates in accordance with law, in accordance with wisdom. Every particular, everything that God has set up is an expression of the infinite Chachmas Hashem. So that's a means. The study of nature is a means for worshiping God. So that's why. That's why we fall. That's why things happen. It's because it's part of the system. Because if it's God's will that the world can function in accordance to, I'm not saying there's a problem. We just so no one should misunderstand. We do believe in miracles. Except belief in miracles is part of our faith. But that's because that, by the way, the belief in miracles is not something that a person who believes in God, as a result of the study of nature, like Einstein, would necessarily have to come to, because it's not a belief which is dictated by human logic. It's something that we know about through the revelation, through God's revelation. No, but the problem would be that if it's God's will that everything should operate in accordance with the system that He established, so why does God want to make any changes in that system? A miracle would always be a breach in the system. That's the way, by the way, Rashi explained the reaction of Abraham when God told him that Sarah would be having a child as a result of the miracle. He fell on his face and he laughed. And the laughter was a laughter of astonishment. Because to him, the service of God was based upon his recognition of God in the scheme of things, in the laws of nature. To him, that was a perfect system. He couldn't understand that God would change the system just for his sake. That was astonishing to him. The idea, you see, for small people, miracles are not astonishing at all. They take, miracles is the given. That's the essence of everything. But for great people, miracles are astonishing. Because they are so in love and enraptured with the beauty of God's creation that there is, and an awareness, insofar as it's humanly possible, of God's greatness, and that's not even a bad word, we can't even use the word, that if this is God's will, then the idea that this should be changed for man is to them something hard to confirm, because man is so small. That's exactly the view of Davina Melech and Tehillim. That's exactly what he says. When I see the words, what is it, the exact process? The exact process is found in Tehillim says, Ki Ere Shonecha, when I view your heavens, Maasei Etzvosecha, the works of your fingers, Yerech V'Chacham Masher Kononta, the moon and the stars that you have established. He's talking about the whole system. Right? Mo'eno Shkisishirem. What is man that you remember? Ven Adam Shkisishirem. And the son of man that you deal with him, so to speak. Shkisishirem was in the sense of relating to him. Remembering him in the sense of relating to him. You see, that expresses the view of the perfected individual that recognizes that above and beyond the system of causation, there is a phenomenon of providence where God does relate to man, but he finds that astonishing. That he finds to be totally astonishing. In contradiction to the view of the ordinary religious person, who just the opposite. Why doesn't God do this to me? Why doesn't he do that? In other words, which is based upon a complete magnification of man. An overestimation of man and his importance in the scheme of things. A person should be humble. The reason why people have problems is because of an absence of humbleness, of humility, and they're involved in stupidity and petty emotional desire, and they elevate that to cosmic significance and blame God when he doesn't conform to all of these ridiculous things. The truth of the matter is that God does relate to man. But not in the way that the ordinary individual imagines or wants it to be. You've got to get rid of that feeling that the world has to function the way you want it to be for you. It's a narcissistic phenomenon, and it really is the cause of most of the religious issues that people have to grapple with. So, you know, a person has to perfect himself and remove himself from a lot of these emotions that he brings with him into yoga, into religion. The point that Mel's raising, that this woman was in a tornado and she had prayed and she was saved, so she's saying now she knows there's God. That's not really a knowledge of God at all. We would not view that as a knowledge of God. That's not knowledge of God. That is a very, you know, egotistic, self-centered phenomenon. It's the God of your imagination. It has nothing to do with objective reality. I could say that was an accident that she was there. And it has no connection to her prayer. Maybe she just got lucky, if you want to use that expression. Because what about all the other people involved?
Yeah.
What about them?
Well, there's a reason.
What's the reason? I mean, she doesn't know what that reason is.
Well,
yeah, the reason is because they're not important to God. Because she's God's favorite. That's what most people are looking for. You see, that infantile relationship with a God. Now, this Agarupa, what struck me this morning in the New York Times, the reaction to the trial of Timothy McVeigh, mass murder or something like that? Terrorism, domestic terrorism. It's very, very interesting. I think it contains a very important lesson for Jews and for Israel, because he was found guilty, so there's tremendous exultation, tremendous celebration, which is understandable. Now there's the penalty phase of the trial, and you know, they were interviewing people, what they really wanted, and to just about virtually every one of them, maybe one exception, nothing will satisfy them except the death penalty, and the extent of what they went through, and the pain, and therefore, this person deserved anything less than the death penalty. And to see this person suffer or whatever, wouldn't be judged. Now, the article points out that many of these, I guarantee you, these people are not people that would have called for the death penalty unless it's only because this event occurred to them. Because these people actually admitted that they were not in favor. I think if you make a study of these people, you'll find that the majority of these people, their views have been affected by what happened to them. It's a purely selfish phenomenon. And I find it disgusting. I'll be very honest with you. It's cruelty. It means to say, this thing was going on. People were killing. Others were suffering. But you were conscientiously opposed to the death penalty. So your whole attitude now has nothing to do with any new ideas, with any objective considerations. But the thing is like this. What was lacking was a specific emotion. You had not been violated. So as long as it wasn't you that was being violated, somebody else was being violated, so then you looked at things differently. Now, I think the Mussar Haskell for Israel is that these types of things are what affect Israel. In other words, Israel doesn't have the death penalty. Israel is concerned about world opinion. So what is the whole value of world opinion? It's a weak read. It's meaningless. It's nothing. You see that all the opinion changes as soon as an event happens. It just goes like that. And I would like to ask these people, Israel's being criticized. Because of the torture?
Yeah.
What a world of total hypocrites. Guaranteed, if Israel were to have executed terrorists, these very same people in Oklahoma a few years ago, and took a poll, they would have criticized Israel for executing them. But I wonder what they would say now. Now, of course, they'd have to realize that since they're calling for the death penalty, for the death penalty, they'd have to be somewhat consistent. Now, I would like to interview these people and ask them, in retrospect, let's say we would have captured, who's the other guy that's on trial with him? One of the guys, Nickel or somebody else, had been captured. Let's say an individual had been captured, and they were aware of this network, and they were aware they were planning some kind of a bombing like this. And the only way to get that information would have been through the use of physical pressure, or what we would call some type of torture. Would you have condoned the use of torture? In retrospect now, play it back in your mind. To therefore, as a result of that, you would have obtained information and you would have prevented the bombing and all of your loved ones would be with you today. What would be your policy? Whatever your answer to that question, that should be your policy with regard to Israel. That's what Israel is dealing with right now. The issue is not that the policy of torture, you could be wrong. If that's the case, that same objection could apply to any punishment that you could name. Death penalty. So many people use that argument, which could be wrong. But I say, so what about life in prison? That could be worse than death.
No,
I understand. We don't recognize there is a difference. Whatever you want to say, the justice of a punishment is unrelated to the possibility that it could be used against an innocent person. If that's a possibility that exists in any system, that's a possibility, then don't give police guns and don't allow them to ever shoot the gun, because they could make a mistake and the guy could be innocent. He looks like he's involved in all of them. No society can accept the thing, if that is the idea. And I don't see why, if that's the case, then why do we all have plans of life? Accidents do occur, people do die, so then let's stop living. That's not a legitimate argument, that mistakes could be made, because if that's the case, then you have no right to ever impose any kind of a punishment. Torture is not a punishment. Torture is a means of interrogation. Now, of course, I'm not saying just use it. I'm not saying just round up anybody who has been start torturing them. That's not the point. It's got to be, of course, to impose such a policy. It would have to be against people that you have reason to assume are involved. You can't. No one is saying to use it indiscriminately. But if you were to capture Nazis, for example, during World War II, I guarantee you, or Japanese officers that had information about Pearl Harbor and other planned attacks, kamikaze bombs, and so forth. And the only way to extract that information would be through torture. What do you think the United States would have done? Well, certainly they would have done it, but even if they wouldn't have done it, they would be insane not to do it. And they'd be cruel and murderous not to do a thing like that. And what are you going to tell the parents of a child or of a soldier who was killed because you were too fastidious to use torture? It didn't conform to your sense of things. Any sane person would say that's immoral. You see, there's no one, that's why everybody in the world today operates purely according to emotions. And then that's why you don't rely on world opinion. You need the world to approve this approval, world approval that we don't have a death penalty. Well, these very same people now are thrilled there's a death penalty. It's a weak read. It's just human, you see the weakness of it. You're dealing with human beings that don't function in accordance with any system, with any ideas. It's purely emotionalism. Now there's a new emotion in the picture. It's my kid, it's me that's been hurt. It's basically, an expression of violated self-love. I can't take this, I can't tolerate it. I need to see that person punished to even the score. It's revenge. It's an emotional revenge. That's the whole world. So but when they're talking about Israel and its problems, there they don't have that particular emotion. In fact, there may even be hostility against Israel, so that's been immense. Yeah, you should be able to tolerate. You should tolerate. You should make concessions. You should allow them to have a state. And if you have to have sacrifices for peace, sacrifices for peace. It's a noble ideal. You! But we won't make any sacrifices for our peace. Israel needs leaders who are able to point us out and to educate the people that we shouldn't be affected by these types of things.
It can't be exactly so.
We have the Torah. We have to live it in accordance with Torah standards, not in accordance with the whims. Even being secular, speak it from a secular standpoint. Even without Torah, one could see this. Why doesn't one make such an argument? Imagine telling a parent who lost their kid on a suicide bombing, and you had individuals in custody, you had the information, but you didn't extract it from them because you were prohibited from using physical torture. What are you going to tell such a person? I mean, if it was me, I'd want to kill that person. Yeah, I'd want to kill that person. You're a murderer. You could have prevented this murder. And because of your stupid emotions, your unenlightened attitude towards things, your fears of the world, of what people would think about you, you're responsible. You could have prevented it. You should have tortured him. Of course you should have tortured him. We're just discussing... This is a sort of agavocha, a side point, because there's a lesson to be learned that very often athletes will take a tremendous risk to win a game. And they'll hurt themselves, and they may even be disabled. And